the show that's focused on investing strategies for today's needs and tomorrow's goals. This is Bucket Strategy Investing, presented by the Wealth Advisors at Lucia Capital Group. Now, here are Johnny Dean and Rick the Professor Plum.
And welcome back to the program. Of course, it is Bucket Strategy Investing. We are back with more. We're taking money advice to the highest level ever seen by mankind since the Buchanan administration. When was the Buchanan administration?
We were talking about that yesterday.
I know, we were. What was it? It was somewhere in the 1800s. That I can guarantee you.
That's pretty good.
Somewhere during that lost period between like 1840 and 1860, okay? Anyway, it's been a long time. Once again, our professor, Rick Plum, here with me. I'm Johnny Dean, standing by, ready to take your phone calls and your emails, naturally. We're going to get started with some of those emails here in just a couple of moments. Now, later on this hour, because it's a busy hour, as you would expect, every week at this time it is, we're going to talk about the various distribution methods that you might consider once you've hit retirement. How much should you take out of your portfolio? Have you heard 4%? I have. Professor Plum has. Have you seen less than that? 1.9%? 2%? Well, it seems like an easy question to answer, but in reality, if you employ the wrong distribution method, meaning one that doesn't take into account your goals and your situation, you could be headed for trouble. So, what's the right way to do it? We'll talk about that with Professor Plum later on this hour. Also, our loan financial planner, Steve Allendort, will be knocking on our door here shortly. He'll be here in about 15 minutes to talk about some new investor guidelines you need to be aware of, especially if you own multiple single-family residences that have mortgages. Steve's got some very good news for you. I'm told that's coming up. Our number here in studio, 877-PLANNER. 877-PLANNER. Show just getting started, so right now we got every line open for you. Take advantage of the opportunity you have right now to call the show and ask your money question. You can also send us your emails, wealthed.com, our website at the Find Your Answer link. You'll see that there near the top of the page. We'll get to some emails shortly. Professor Plum returns with me again this hour, courtesy of the advisors at Lucia Capital Group. They want to remind you that your retirement needs are, of course, vastly different from anyone else's. Since no two situations are alike, it's important that you have a retirement plan that focuses specifically on your goals as an individual. With Lucia Capital Group, you have access to an entire network of brain trust advisors, and they're ready to help you out. Expert help is essential here, folks. Do not tackle all this on your own. Call them directly off the air, 800-644-1150, 800-644-1150. If you're too shy to talk on the air, that's what you do. You can talk to Professor Plum or any of the nationwide brain trust advisors, 800-644-1150. Our number on the air, 877-PLANNER. We do have a lot of stuff to get to. Also, emails. In fact, Professor Plum, we're going to start with a couple of emails here. Some of these came in, I think, during the Buchanan administration.
As we found out, it's 1857 to 1861, a one-term president.
Hey, not bad. So he was right before Lincoln.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a one-termer. Okay. A little ashamed I should know that.
You don't know it.
Well, I mean, history was one of my big topic subjects in college.
Old Buck was his nickname.
Yeah, Old Buck? Mm-hmm. Buck Buchanan? Buck Buchanan, number 86, Kansas City Chiefs. Hall of Famer. Great guy. Love that guy. All right. Anyway, Jonathan in Tacoma, Washington asks this. My mother has a home sale pending in California. She's 87 years old, and my father passed away early in 2015. They paid $18,300 for the house, and it's selling for $510,000. I heard you say the first $250,000 can be excluded from taxes, but does she have to pay taxes on the rest? I read somewhere that if someone dies within 2 years of a home sale, the full $500,000 exclusion may apply. Do you know if that's true?
Well, actually, it is true. You have 2 years after the death of an individual to use their $250,000 exclusion. But I don't think the gain is going to be as much as you think, because it was in California. California being a community property state, the basis of that individual property, even though mom and dad paid, what,
$18,300
back in the Buchanan administration, it received a new basis, most likely, when dad died. And the basis would have been equal to the value at the date of his death. The entire basis, because California being a community property state, it would have stepped up the entire basis on the account. Which means that only gain since his passing would be a gain, and that would be easily wiped out by the $250,000 exclusion that she has. So it's either way, it's unlikely that she would have, enough gain to worry about. And even if she did, it's not going to be $500,000 worth of gain. And she does have both her exemption of $250,000 and your late father's exemption of $250,000 as long as it's sold within 2 years after his passing.
So they have to close escrow and do all that before the
But even if it day. Doesn't, I mean, California, it was either in his name or it was community property, as both of their names, or it was joint property. It's unlikely that it was in your mom's name only. That would be the only way that it would screw that particular resetting of the basis up.
Yeah, so if it was entirely in his name, which is possible because, I mean, you're
If it's entirely in his name or it's community property, either one.
It goes to her.
The basis is the value that it was in 2015 when he passed away.
Yeah, so
we haven't had that much appreciation since 2015.
No, it's probably unlikely. Okay, there's your answer, Jonathan. Appreciate the question. This is John in Houston, Texas. I turned 66 in April and did a file and suspend on Social Security.
Made the deadline there.
I guess so. Yeah, right under the wire. My wife will be 66 in October of 2016. At age 62, she started drawing $500 from her Social Security.
Oops. Okay, keep going. Sorry.
No.
Commentary
right.
as we go.
I plan to work until at least age 68. My benefit would be $2,100 if I took it right now. Does my wife have to be 66 to draw half of my Social Security? Otherwise, she draws a reduced benefit. Do you have a better plan?
Well, unfortunately, because she took her benefit early, there will always be a reduced benefit on the spousal benefit. It's going to be equal to the difference between her benefit at the time she applies for the spousal benefit, not the number she's actually receiving. So let's say she starts taking it at 66. If she had waited until 66, her benefit would have been about $667. But she took it early. She took it at age at 62. So she took a $170 haircut on her benefit to be able to start receiving it early at age 62. That $170 haircut will still be there when she turns 66 and she applies for your benefit, half of your benefit. So what they're going to do is they're going to look at half of your benefit being $1,050 minus her benefit, which should have been $670, and she'll receive a difference of the two numbers. Not all the way back to the difference between $500 that she's receiving, but what she would have received at 66 when she applied for this benefit. So she's going to get a benefit, and she should, when she turns 66, apply for the spousal benefit. It won't be the full 50% number, but then again, it never will be the 50% number because she took her benefit early. But it's more than what she's receiving, and so she might as well start receiving it.
Yeah, so now if she hadn't started taking her own benefit and had just allowed it to grow, she could, at age 66, have applied and gotten the $1,050
Right, she could have received
benefit.
The full 50%. If she had not started receiving $500 a month, she would have had to give up $6,000 a year for 4 years, $24,000,
right.
to then get the $1,000, and her benefit would have never caught up to that $1,000 anyway. So it probably was the right thing to do, start hers early, especially since she wasn't working, and then you're going to let yours grow until age 70, or at least until you quit working, it sounds like. It sounds like you're doing the right thing. Have her apply for a benefit. She can apply for a benefit as early as she wants because you have suspended. You suspended under the deadline of the old rules. You're allowed to do that and let her still take a benefit from you. That's what the April deadline allows you to do. So, you know, that would be something to look at. I don't know if I'd wait. When is she going to be 66?
She'll be 66 in a few months.
Yeah, you might as well apply now. Get the money now.
Yeah,
it's going to be $300 a month or so.
The cut that she'll take isn't going to...
It's minor, very minor.
By a couple of months. So she will get... they will take her $667, call it, whatever her full retirement age is, roughly.
Well, if she waits until 66 to do it, yes.
Let's say she does that. So $667. The full retirement age benefit would have been $1,050.
Right.
But we have to take money off of that.
Right. They're looking at it as... they're going to give her a combination of two benefits, her benefit and the difference between her benefit and the spouse benefit. But they're not going to look at her benefit as what she's receiving. They're going to look at her benefit as of the time that she applies for the spousal benefit. She gets the difference between those two amounts as of that date. But the fact that so they're going to basically say you're receiving your benefit and you took a reduction in your benefit, so that reduction is going to apply to the spousal benefit as well.
It's the same dollar amount, you're saying.
Yeah.
167 or whatever it is, roughly, off of the 1050.
Yeah, it's like $666.66, and I just wanted to avoid that.
We're going to call it $667 just to, because we're going to round the cents up.
And I'm sure the 500 was rounded, so
it was. So whatever it happens to be, but you know, that's a difference of a few hundred bucks a month.
Yeah, but she will get an increase. You know, so you know, probably $350-$400 or so, depending. You know. It's not a bad little increase right now.
No, it's not. And we don't know anything about longevity, so I'm guessing perhaps one of the reasons she started taking her Social Security at age 62, perhaps she does not have a great deal of longevity.
And or they wanted the money.
Well, either one. That's true. All right, 877-PLANNER. If you've got money questions, we've got money answers for you. And we're going to excuse Professor Plum for just a moment, in fact, for a segment. And we're going to bring in our loan financial planner, Steve Alladort. Steve has got some news for you if you happen to own multiple single-family residences. Some new things coming down the pike. Steve's going to tell us all about that. We'll also get all the latest information on rates, etc. And then we'll bring Professor Plum back after the bottom of the hour. 877-PLANNER, Johnny Dean and the Brain Trust coming right back. Bucket Strategy Investing. Well, I love presenting good news every once in a while on this program. And I love it even more when our loan financial planner, Steve Alladort, brings it in. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum will be back in a little bit, but we do have our loan financial planner, Steve Alladort, here from Skyline Home Lending, yet another member of the Brain Trust. You can reach him at loan online, L-O-A-N, loanfinancialplanner.com. Or you can call him directly at 888-563-1070, although he won't answer the phone for the next probably 8 or 9 minutes. Steve, welcome back to the program.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, first thing, rates. Where are we doing on rates?
Rates, again, have been holding pretty steady. Okay. You know, we had a week or two where there was a little bit of an upward pressure. Then we had a couple of good days.
Okay.
Now we're getting a little bit of an upward pressure, but the trading range is so narrow. We're still looking, you know, on purchases, 30-year. You know, as low as 3.3 with minimal to no points, 7-year in the, you know, high 2, low 3% range, government loans 3.1 to 3.5, and then jumbo purchases, aggressive, you know, 3.5, 3.6 on a 30 and as below 3%. On a 7-year with a significant amount of cash down.
I keep waiting for that to change. I keep waiting for that to revert to where it used to be, where those loans were just a little bit higher. But they're not yet.
Not yet. They could eventually inch up, but okay. So far they've been holding pretty steady.
Okay, good. Now, I mentioned good news for investors, people that happen to own multiple single-family residence properties. What is going on here?
We actually are going to come into, and I believe it's sometime in September, a really nice change. So these are for borrowers that own 4 or more single-family, 1 to 4 residences with mortgages. And if you're looking to buy number 5 as an investment property, or you already have more than 4 or 5 and you're looking to purchase or even refinance, we've got a lot more flexible guidelines, which is really inviting those people that have shown the ability to be able to manage investment properties the opportunity to potentially buy more. So I'll kind of walk through. Here's some of the neat changes.
Yeah. Well, what do we have now before the changes?
All right. So current, if you are, and this only applies if you own that many properties and you're looking to do an investment property purchase or refinance.
Yeah.
If you have a primary residence, doesn't matter how many properties that you own. So this is if you're looking to either buy or do a refinance on an existing investment property. So previous on a purchase. One unit down payment was at least 25%, not the 20% that we can do with less than.
Right, so you had to have 25% down on an investment.
On one unit, right. And 30% on 2 to 4 units. Now they're going back to the guidelines as if you own less than 4, with 20% down on one unit and 25% on 2 to 4 units.
Okay,
so less money that you need to put down to purchase that next investment property.
Are these coming from Fannie and Freddie? Where
Correct.
Are these coming from?
Correct. This is Fannie and Freddie.
All right.
On a refinance, if you are looking to refinance an existing rental property and you own more than 4 total, 70% was the total max loan to value and total loan to value if you had a line of credit. So if you had 2 loans, we couldn't go above 70% combined with both. The new guidelines is we can go up to 75% on the first loan, and if you have a line of credit, we can do total loans up to 85%. So a lot more flexibility as far as doing a rate and term refinance.
You know, that's just very quickly, that's a big difference. People say, well, 70, 75, what's the difference? That can make quite a bit of difference, you know, depending on how much the property
absolutely.
Costs.
And if you've owned the property for a long period of time, you know, up until about 2007, people did a lot of equity lines. We're not seeing as many now.
Right.
So that was stopping those people from being able to refinance because they had that line of credit.
Yeah.
Now it's going to give us that flexibility. As far as wanting to pull cash out of an existing rental property, and you, again, owning more than five total properties, you couldn't pull cash out previously.
Not at all.
It, sometime in September, when these guidelines actually go into effect, we can go up to 75%, just as if you were only owned one or two.
Wow.
That is a really, really positive benefit. Credit scores. If you own more than four total properties with mortgages and you were looking to do an investment, purchase a refi, you had to have a credit score of 720 or higher. Now, it's normal credit score guidelines. I mean, the lower the credit score, the higher the interest rate you'll pay. And you only are required to have that 720 if you own between 7 and up to 10 properties.
Okay, so you could own 5 or 6 properties.
And you could have a credit score of 690 and still be able to do something.
Okay.
Whereas previously, if you were at 720,
was the drop dead line right there?
You couldn't do anything.
Wow. All right.
As far as mortgage rates, none in the last 12 months was the old guidelines.
When you say that, you're talking about late payments on any mortgage.
And that would be 30 days or late. That's showing up on the credit report. Now, there may be a mortgage late, but as long as it passes through either the Fannie Mae underwriting engine, which we call DU, or the Freddie Mac, which we call LP, then we're good. Then it doesn't matter if you had an accidental late payment, something weird
passing
happened.
Through meaning what?
You input everything into the system based on credit score, loan to value, reserves. It will then come back and tell us that you're approved. So all the loans that we do with Fannie and Freddie, you actually are put through a underwriting engine that takes all of the info that we've put in. And it tells us, yes, we like your loan and we will buy it from you, or no, we won't. And you got to figure out how to maybe manipulate things.
It's like the magic eight ball. I mean, you can just all whatever comes up through the window.
It's the magic eight ball. I mean, I've had scenarios where a borrower, if I eliminated a $25 a month payment, I went from getting a decline to an approval. So, yes, it's that magic eight ball.
Wow. All right. Now, what about bankruptcies, if you had bankruptcies or
and foreclosures? Again, if you own more than four properties, there were none in the last 7 years.
You could not have any.
Correct. Both bankruptcies and foreclosures. The new one will be the standard. 4 for bankruptcy, 7 for foreclosure. And on the reserve side, this is where the big difference is. On 2 to 4, on above 4 properties, you would have to have 6 months reserves on every property that you owned, including the one that you were either looking to do the purchase or the refinance.
6 months of mortgage payment.
Correct. So if your average mortgage payment is $2,000 a month,
you have 12 grand in there.
That's on each property. Own 5 properties or 6 properties, we're looking at you. We need to show that you've got $70,000 or $80,000 put away.
All right. Now
the new guidelines is going to be a percent of the total loan amounts of your investment properties. So up from 1 to 4 properties, it's 2% of your total mortgages. So let's assume that your total mortgages are $500,000, you would only need $10,000 in reserves. If you own 5 to 6 properties, it's 4% of your total loans. So let's say you own $900,000 in total loans, you'd need $36,000 in reserves. And from 7 to 10 properties, it's 6% for each property. So that would be, let's say you had a $1.2 million in mortgages, you would have to have about $76,000 in reserves.
So you still have to have reserves, but the requirements, of course, are a whole lot less now.
Correct.
For people who are going to own. So the whole point, we're out of time, but the whole point is to get people to who would like to invest in more properties to give them some flexibility.
People that have shown a history of being able to manage investment properties, the opportunity to potentially buy more.
That's great news for these folks. And if you need to have any questions, Steve, you can handle that for anybody, can't
Absolutely.
You? Yes, you can give them a call, 888-563-1070. Talk to Steve Alador, or you can also call, get in touch with him at Skyline Home Lending at his website, Loan, L-O-A-N, financialplanner.com. Loan Financial Planner. Steve, thanks. We'll see you next
Always
week.
Always a pleasure.
Take care. Professor Rick Plum rejoins me. Bucket Strategy Investing. More coming up. Don't go away. Taking your phone calls, Johnny Dean and Professor Rick Plum back with me once again. 877-PLANNER, our number, P-L-A-N-N-E-R, 877-752-6637. We got a lot of questions to get to. We had quite a few emails coming in, and several of them had to do with Social Security. And I want to remind you, too, that there's a whole separate Social Security show featuring me and Professor Rick Plum. It's on live every single week. You can catch us Tuesday afternoons if you want to watch live, only at WealthEd.com. 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern Time. It's the Social Security Show. We do answer your email questions. We also answer your phone calls on that program. You can call any time of the day or night at 800-838-0483. And if you missed that number, it's there at WealthEd.com. You can call, leave your question on the voicemail. Or you know something? Hey, even while we're on live on the show, just give us a call. I bet we can answer it during the show. We've done that a couple of times, too. It's only a half hour, but there's a whole lot of information there. Weekly, WealthEd.com, Social Security Show featuring me, Johnny Dean, and Professor Plum. Brought to you by Lucia Capital Group at WealthEd.com. All right, our phone lines are open now. 877-PLANNER. We have all the lines open. 877-752-6637. We're going to take your phone calls here in just a couple of moments. And just before we really get into some of this stuff, Professor Rick Plum, we're going to be talking in just a little bit about the 4%. You wouldn't call it really a rule, although a lot of people refer to it as a rule. What do we mean by this?
Well, it's just a matter of how much can you potentially withdraw from a portfolio. And if everything goes right, you won't run out of money. And if everything goes right, okay, what happens if everything doesn't go right? Well, the idea is that even if everything doesn't go right, you should be able to, according to the statistics that they've played with, be able to take, and it wasn't even 4%, it was 4.5% when they did this back in the 90s.
4.5% when they originally ran the numbers.
Right, in the 90s, when yes. when Mr. Benjamin redid the rule from the 80s, which was more like a 6% distribution. And he was wondering, with the declining interest rates and things of the 90s compared to the 80s and the change in economics, would a 6% distribution still hold up?
And by hold up, we mean
if you
last
started with
for
a million,
30 years.
Plus inflation, taking yeah. the 6 or whatever percent you decide to take plus inflation. And they were dealing with a flat 50-50 portfolio or a 60-40 stock bond mix.
Right.
Just one portfolio based on the S&P, and I think it was intermediate bonds, but... would it be able to sustain a distribution over an individual's expected or even longer than expected life expectancy at that time? They did a 30-year time horizon. They're saying if you're retiring at 60, they want we want this portfolio to last, even though we're taking money out of it, until for 30 years, 65 to 95, 60 to 90. And they just said, what are the probabilities that a portfolio would last given different starting times throughout history?
And they, and of course, interest rates, as you said, they have to make some assumptions about where interest rates were going to be.
Well, the original rule just looked historically. They didn't do any projecting forward. They just said, over historical terms, could this have happened? Could we have taken a distribution of, and they use multiple different rates of return to see where the fail rate would be. And say, said, you know, starting in, you know, 1931, 1929, you know, all the way through, and saying, at what rate, how often did it fail at these potential
yes.
distribution rates? And when they first did it, they only did it on historical terms. They didn't do any projecting forward. It wasn't until recently that they've been changing the 4% rule, guideline, whatever you want to call it, to look into the future and saying, you know, what happened in the past isn't happening now, specifically interest rates.
Yeah, and that's the big thing. And I guess the reason, Professor Plum, we're going to take a call in a second, the reason that they started looking forward was because they said, hey, look at interest rates, where they've been. We never figured on this happening.
Right, and they're saying, well, sure, it worked in the historical terms when interest rates were higher, but
yes.
the today's interest rate have an impact on the ability to take a distribution from a portfolio. And that's what they've been arguing and debating and running against, and which is right. What is an appropriate amount of money that you may be able to distribute from a portfolio?
Well,
based on a 50-50 mix, you may have one answer. Based on other ideas, you may have different answers.
Exactly. And some of those different answers are going to be coming up here when we have a couple of moments. But we do want to take your phone calls because that's what we do on this program. Once again, 877-PLANNER, our number, PLANNER. Get on board, talk to the Brain Trust with whatever money issue you have. Let's move along next to Ross, Pahrump, Nevada. Hello, Ross.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Okay, so far. However,
a couple of years ago,
my wife passed away, and I inherited her IRA. I took this money from one bank, and I drove to another bank and put it into my IRA.
Okay.
Now IRS is sending me a demand letter for a large sum of money plus penalties and interest for undeclared income. Any advice or guidance?
Okay, and what they're saying is the undeclared income is the amount of money withdrawn from her IRA and put into your IRA. Is that true?
Yes, except they don't say it's put into my IRA. They just say it's undeclared income.
Right, so what's happening is, now you must have taken a distribution and took a check in hand, right?
Correct.
And then you walked across town or whatever and wrote them a check to the new custodian for the exact same amount. Am I still on the right track?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, what year was this?
2014.
Okay. On your 2014 tax return, did you show a distribution of X amount of dollars, whatever it was, on your tax return, and a taxable amount of zero? Did you account for it on your return?
No, I did not.
That's what they're upset about.
Okay, what happened was the bank sent the W-2 form to a bad address.
Right, the 1099.
And I didn't get it for a few months.
Okay.
When I finally got it, I went back to my tax man and was going to do a 1040X or whatever it is, an amended return.
Right.
And he said no need because it comes out the exact same amount.
Right, but all you have to do now is show the IRS that the money was properly rolled over within the 60-day time horizon that's allowed. So you're going to need to show the date that it left, go back to the first bank and get the statement for that month, and show the statement for the same month or the next month with the new IRA. You know, write them a little letter, have your accountant help you or whatever, and say, this was a proper rollover within 60 days moving from my late wife's IRA, I am the named beneficiary, over to my own IRA. They're just upset because they got a 1099 that shows a bunch of taxable income with no accounting on your return, and so they're saying, hey, we just found a jackpot. This guy owes us a bunch of money, when in reality, you don't owe him any money.
Oh, good.
So it's just
a matter of me, I screwed up.
Letter, they're asking for an explanation. It was probably a letter saying, we are going to change your tax liability for 2014 unless you can explain why we should not change it. So on your letter back to them, say, I am explaining it to you. Here is the distribution on such and such a date. Here is the contribution or subsequent reinvestment into another IRA on such and such a date, well within the 60 days. I was the named beneficiary of IRA X. I am the owner of IRA Y. It happened. Sorry it didn't show up on the tax return. Go away. That's what you're telling the IRS. But
I'll do that.
Say it nicely.
Thank you so much for your advice. I feel better now.
Yes.
Just say it nicely, though.
Say it nicely, yeah, because they'll work. You did get it. You did walk across the street to the other bank within the 60 days of taking it out, right?
That's a big street.
Yes.
You didn't wait more than...
I feel a little better.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Good. Yeah, you
thank
should
you
be
so
okay,
much,
but get that done, okay?
Yeah, the problem was...
I will do.
The problem was...
Thank you, Ross. Appreciate the call.
The IRS's records don't match up with Ross's tax return. Yes, it was a tax-free rollover. It didn't cost him anything in taxes. And the ultimate bottom line was a zero, difference in taxation. But they've got a 1099 that says, 20, 30, 50, 100, however much it was that was taken out of the first IRA, and there's no corresponding accounting for it on the tax return. So they're saying, hey, we have a discrepancy. Please explain this discrepancy to us. And we're open to appropriate, documentation. It's not that they're coming after you hard, Ross, and thankfully you have an excuse for this, but it is, even when you know you're right, and he didn't know that he was right at the time, that getting that letter from the IRS just stinks.
Well, it is, because it looks like, what they're going to do is say, here's what you owe us, now tell us why you don't.
Right.
Now, he had to have walked across the street or whatever and done all this within 60 days. It sounds like he did.
Right.
And so that's not a problem. Now, did they write the check to him?
This is a rollover, yes.
Yeah. So would they have taken? Would there have been any 20%?
No, there's no mandatory withholding from an IRA.
Okay, so when you're rolling it,
if there's $100,000, there's $1 million in there. You can ask for a check for the entire million.
Yeah.
And it's up to you to do your proper payment of tax if you don't roll it over.
What they're doing is
the 401ks, qualified retirement plans have the mandatory 20%.
Yes. Okay.
IRAs don't fall into that.
Okay, I just want to clear that up. What they're doing is they're in essence distributing the IRA money to you.
They made a distribution.
The first bank
made a distribution of the entire IRA to Ross.
Right, and Ross went away, and they said, that's all we know is we made a distribution. So they said, here's a 1099, we're going to send it, because this is a distribution.
And
you cancel that.
Ross didn't get the 1099 because it went to a different address.
Exactly. So that's part of the problem. But
well, and a lot of people look at it and say, well, it's tax-free. Why do I have to do anything with it?
Because the IRS is missing one key,
because
and they don't know
about it. Because there's a discrepancy
exactly.
at the IRS's records.
Yes, that's the way it works. Yeah, that's what you said. We've said this before. Even though you know you're right, even though you say, I know this is a tax-free rollover, if there is a 1099 issued, and he would have taken care of this if he'd gotten the 1099. You just have to tell the IRS, yes, leave me alone.
And the 1040X wouldn't have shown anything because It just shows differences, and there's no difference.
1040X amended return. Okay, we got to take a break here. We got still some room on the phones. 877-PLANNER, PLANNER. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, the Brain Trust from Lucia Capital Group, coming back, Bucket Strategy Investing. Bucket Strategy Investing, Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, talking to you about your money strategies. We sort of mentioned a little bit last segment about some of the 4% rule/guideline. Since we got a couple emails to get to, and there's a lot of stuff to talk about on this 4%, the whole idea of taking 4% out of your portfolio, I'm going to push this to next segment, next hour. So if you happen to pick up the show next hour, that's where we're going to talk a little bit more about that, because it really involves a whole lot of strategy. And what it comes down to is the strategy is probably the withdrawal strategy, the distribution strategy is probably what's creating problems with this so-called 4% or 2% or whatever percentage you want to take it out, not necessarily the number itself. So we're going to get into that. We will do some more of that next hour. Professor Plum. But let's get to a couple more emails here. And again, 877-PLANNER, our number. If you want to get on board, we do have some room on the phones, 877-752-6637. Donna in Fort Worth, Texas. I don't know. I haven't seen this question before. If U.S. banks begin the negative interest rates charged to customers, as Germany just did for deposits over 100,000 euros, why wouldn't customers just put their deposits in multiple banks in amounts under the threshold to avoid the charge?
I don't see why they wouldn't. I don't see why they wouldn't pull their money out of banks and just hoard cash. You know, it's interesting, though. I just saw a stat on a couple of the countries in Europe that have a negative interest rate, and the whole idea is to stimulate borrowing and some other things. And their savings rate went up. People are saving even more.
What?
Yeah.
How? Why? Not in banks.
But in different banks. Maybe they're keeping it right under their threshold. If that were to happen, you're going to see a lot of different things that we've ever done before move around and change. So instead of keeping only $250,000 in a bank up to the FDIC limits, they may keep only $100,000 up to the negative interest rate limits. I mean, will it happen?
No,
I don't know.
It's not going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen.
It is not going to happen.
But then I've been wrong about the future before, so I could be wrong this time. It's just an interesting exercise. We don't know what's going to happen if that were to happen, and I don't know how probable that happening is.
I would say it's pretty darn close to zero. I mean, one of the reasons the Fed exists is to avoid things like negative interest rates, and I just don't think that that's going to happen.
Now, we have had a couple of years ago, we had an I-bond auction. I-bonds Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. They go off at auction, and they came off with basically a negative interest rate. The amount of interest they were paying based on the price people were paying would have created less money coming back. It cost people too much money. They had to have some inflation. Now, those people may not have gotten the inflation they were hoping for, and they may actually end up not getting back everything they put into
yeah.
it.
Yeah, but that, of course, is based on the structure, the way the payments are set up within those Treasury inflation-protected securities.
Right. Let's say it had it probably had like a 0.25% interest rate. People were paying like 104, 105 on
right.
a five-year bond.
Yeah.
Where the interest, so they paid $105,000 on a $100,000 bond, and they were going to get maybe $1,000 back in interest, unless we had substantial inflation.
Which, if we didn't,
meant they got back less than they paid for it.
Right, exactly. But that's, those are really bonds.
It is a bond, and it's a strange way to look at it. People get caught up in the moment and outbid things. It's like an auction, any other
auction. Well, exactly, and you can lose money on bonds just about any time. So, I mean, it's not all that unusual. Okay, let's see. I want to get to a shorter one here. Gage in Sarasota, Florida. We were just talking about rollovers. He says, I have a variable annuity that I purchased 11 years ago, along with a traditional IRA. I'm 49 years old, and I'd like to roll one over into the other. Is it better to roll the traditional into the variable annuity or vice versa?
Well, unfortunately, neither. If you have a variable annuity that you own personally and you have an IRA, you cannot roll the variable annuity and just change the title from your name to the IRA's name. Can't do that. The only way to get the money from this account into your IRA is to cash it in and then make contributions, if you're allowed to the IRA. You can't just change a security name to an IRA. It doesn't work that way. There's only two ways, basically, to get money into an IRA: annual contributions or rollovers from qualified retirement plans, 401ks, pension plans, things like that. A variable annuity, a non-qualified personally owned variable annuity, is not a qualified plan. It can't be rolled over. And so the only way to get the money out is to cash it in. Cash it in. Whatever earnings are in the variable annuity will be taxable and penalized because you're not 59 and a half. So that could be a fairly expensive thing to do. On the other side, you're 49 years old. I can't think of a single reason why I would put a variable annuity inside of an IRA. So I don't want to put the IRA money into a variable annuity either, because at 49, you're a little young for these guaranteed withdrawal benefit riders. That just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
Which would be the only reason to own one, by the way.
That's the only reason I would think of owning it. It doesn't, why pay the variable annuity fees for tax deferral if you're putting it inside of an IRA for tax deferral? Unless it's got some kind of a bell and whistle that you just really love and are willing to pay for, because variable annuities have fees. I don't see why putting a variable annuity inside the IRA is going to give you any advantage, because the bells and whistles don't work for you at 49 years of age. The only thing you want out of it is growth. And growth, if I can have the same investments within the IRA without the variable annuity and that are in the variable annuity are very similar, why would I pay the variable annuity fee? I got a long-term time horizon. I'm not doing it either way.
Right, you could roll annuity money into other annuities. You can do 1035 exchanges and things like that, but you can't do that into a traditional IRA, IRAs to IRAs and that kind of
IRA, thing. IRA is fine. A non-qualified variable annuity to an IRA doesn't work. That is not a rollable opportunity.
Yeah, and I need you to clarify something, too, because we've talked about this before, where you said paying for tax deferral inside of a tax deferral. Now, that does not mean that doing so is always a bad idea.
No, and if you were 59, my choices, my advice may be a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Because 59, and if you wanted guaranteed income, now you're in the window for purchasing one of those types of annuities, a variable annuity or index annuity, with the rider that gives you a guaranteed retirement income. But at 49, you're too young for that. You're paying fees for too long for a benefit that isn't going to be worth its money. At 59, the benefit may be worth the money you're paying for. And when I'm talking about the paying for it, there are fees. And that's one of the biggest problems with variable annuities, are the fees that you have to pay. Mortality and expense charges, rider fees, that the thing, they can add up very quickly. And if you're not going to get any benefit from it, it doesn't make sense to pay the fees for it. And so if you're, like I said, if you're 59, 60, 65, even 67, 68, and you want that guaranteed income, and as long as you understand how it works, then the fee may be okay, because you're looking at, I'm getting a certain value for what I'm paying. On the other side, 49 years old, I don't see how you're going to get the value out of that fee, because it's going to add up a lot, and it's going to hold back everything. And so I wouldn't do it.
So in your mind, there's only one reason that people should own variable annuities at this point. And he doesn't qualify for those reasons. All right. We've got to take a break. We're going to come back with more in another hour. If you need the brain trust off the air, Professor Plum specifically, or any of the Lucia Capital Group advisors help you out with your retirement plan, 800-644-1150. The off-air number, 800-644-1150. Another hour is just ahead of Bucket Strategy Investing.
Information presented should not be considered specific tax, legal, or investment advice. You should always seek counsel of the appropriate advisor prior to making any investment decision. All investments are subject to risk, including the loss of principal. There is no guarantee that any investing or financial planning strategy will be profitable, provide protection from loss, or meet its stated objectives. Investment advisor representatives of Lucia Capital Group are also registered representatives of and offer securities through Lucia Securities, LLC, a registered broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. John Dean is an associated person with Lucia Securities, LLC. In the information presented, the opinions and views expressed are subject to change without notice and may not come to pass. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of skill or training.